Well, I'm here with Stephen Moss to talk about his latest book, Skylarks with Rosie, which he wrote during the lockdown. And we're following the loop that Stephen followed more or less each day, I think, Stephen, didn't you?
That's right, yeah. I was basically from that time, we're talking the first lockdown, of course, yes. From March 2020. And most days I would come round here either with Rosie, who is my Red Fox Labrador, a dog, another female relative, and or on my bike. And more or less every day, sometimes twice a day, despite the government restriction on exercise. So, I was here a lot.
Yeah. And it wasn't a totally negative experience for you. I think, like quite a lot of us, there was compensations of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is a tricky thing, and I say in the book that one of the big issues is, of course, a lot of people, including a lot of people I know, were suffering terribly from COVID, either because they were restricted or ill, or live in very small places that they couldn't go out, and all those things. So I'm not in any way minimising the effects of lockdown, but for me personally, the advantage is, although I had work to do, life became simpler. And I wasn't having to travel, I wasn't having to move around, I was doing slightly less work, and it just allowed a bit of breathing space to appreciate, I suppose, nature very local to my house. We're standing at the moment exactly a mile away from my home, which is the extreme. That's the furthest I went for the first 5 or 6 weeks. And so for me, you know, getting back in touch with nature on this ultra local level, not even going down to the Avalon marshes, was a real joy.
Yeah, I also was fascinated by, and I think perhaps you didn't realise this when you started writing the book, that you've been here 14 years now, I think, haven't you, since you've moved down from London to Mark?
Yes, 15 years this year, so yes, it was 14 years.
And in a way, it felt to me, that you were sort of taking stock a bit of your experiences of being in Somerset all this time. And there's a really, quite a moving moment, I think, when you kind of said, well, this is now my home. You know, you kind of realise this is your home for good, and you've got real no ambitions of moving anywhere else.
No, not only we won't move from Somerset or from the village, we're not going to move from our home. That is it. And I think we knew that when we moved here. We knew it was our last big move. And at the time we were in our 40s and we had 3 very young children, and they've grown up here. They're late teenagers now. And yeah, it felt like life was becoming simpler in those 3 months. Of course, it helped that we had the most magical weather. It was so beautiful at the time.
And not always as windy as today.
Not always as windy as today, yeah. But you know, so yes, it was a book that someone said to me, it's a very personal book, and it didn't set out to be personal, but that's because I literally wrote it as a diary. I edited it afterwards for grammar and, you know, a few repeats of things and that sort of thing, but I didn't change a thing. There was no hindsight, so it is written honestly as to what I felt at the time, and I thought that was really important.
Because it's not just about nature in the end, because I found you getting quite political at times and expressing lots of views, which isn't typical of your books when I read them, you know.
No, more recently
I've the world through a wider prism than just nature.
Yeah, more recently I think all nature writers have realised we have to be more militant on environmental issues.
Yes.
So I've written several books recently, Wild Kingdom and The Accidental Countryside, and also The Swallow, which contain quite a lot about habitat loss, climate change, biodiversity loss. The difference was with this, that I was getting very angry politically with this government. I felt that the way they handled the crisis was criminally irresponsible, and that I had to at least hint at that. I tried to do it in as balanced a way as possible, given how strongly I feel. But I felt that it was time to speak out. And the other element of the book, of course, which is very different from that, is it contains a lot about my family.
Well, I was going to mention that. And I'm wondering, one question here is the fact that you are more strident about questions about the climate and the environment. Was that partly, do you think, to do with the influence of your family?
It was indirectly so, yes, because my children are growing up in a very different world, and they are more privileged than an awful lot of children in Britain. We're very lucky to live here. They go to very good local state schools. You know, we're very lucky. They're getting a good education. But nevertheless, I know from personal experience and from seeing what goes on that they are not part of this corrupt elite that are now effectively, you know, the jobs for the boys, that whole thing. So I felt, and I'm, you know, of course I'm very angry about climate change. So there's a lot, I suppose in the book, it perhaps comes across as less angry and more, I was trying to be more balanced. But there comes a point in life where you have to speak out and say what you feel. And I was very influenced by the fact that, you know, my daughter 2 years ago said, I want to go on the climate change march in Bristol. Yes, and we went. Yeah. And I was really glad we did. And until then, she'd not shown any particular interest in politics. But this affects their lives.
Yes. And I think that's generally true. I found the same with my children who are in their 20s, that very often their opinions are informing mine, you know, and making me think a lot harder about things like the climate issue.
Yes, and of course the joy of last spring was that I was seeing, and hearing in particular, there are 6 or 7 species of warbler that come from all over Africa, literally north, south, east and west Africa. Birds come here to this little tiny patch, the Loop, a piece of farmland, not a nature reserve. And so we get the willow warblers, which I heard in my garden during lockdown, from South Africa. We get the lesser white throats, which winter in East Africa, the sedge warblers and reed warblers and white throats from West Africa, and the black caps and chiffchaffs from North Africa. These birds have made these incredible global journeys, but for how long, given that we are messing up the world?
Yeah.
And maybe we're okay, because maybe at the very last minute, politicians, certainly businesses, some businesses are beginning to realise that we really do have to do something about this. But it felt like it felt almost like the book was an elegy to what might be lost in the next few years we're not careful.
Mm. There are some good news stories on the wildlife front, I think, and this is where it's interesting, I think, for you to look back. Because when you first came down here, you wrote another diary, didn't you, 14 years ago?
That's right. Yes.
Followed by your book, Wild Hares and Hummingbirds, which is one of my favourite of your books.
Oh, thank you.
Of course, they're all favourites, but that's a particular favourite of mine.
Yeah, mine too.
Yeah. But there are some interesting changes. So, you know, marsh harriers are more common than they used to be. A lot of the predators are.
Yeah, marsh harriers here, great white egrets, which I actually saw this winter here. I didn't see while I was writing the book, but they turned up this winter on this little patch of land. Unknown in Somerset 15 years ago. Cattle egrets, of course, are in the area. Little egrets have been here for a while now. So, there are some good news stories about wildlife.
And also on the Somerset levels, the efforts that have been made, you know, when we do make efforts to improve the environment with a purpose, that it really has had some results.
Absolutely. I was there today and I saw bitten 3 times. I saw marsh harriers, hobbies. These are birds that I wouldn't have seen there if certainly 20 years ago, and even 10 years ago, there weren't as many. So we live in a wonderful county. Somerset is brilliant for wildlife. It's got an incredible range of habitats from the coast and the Quantocks and the Mendips and the Levels and Exmoor, of course. But it's very easy if you live on the Somerset Levels to think everything's okay, because by and large, it's farmed reasonably well for wildlife. Compared to, say, where you were brought up in Cambridgeshire, and the conservation bodies here, the Wildlife Trust and the RSPB, are doing a fantastic job. The danger is that we think, you know, particularly with climate change, that all these birds like cattle egrets and great white egrets turn up, and we think everything's great. They're only here for 2 reasons. One, because we've created the habitat, which is brilliant, but they wouldn't be here without the climate emergency, as I prefer to call it now. So what works, if you live in southern Britain, you get all these birds turning up and it's all wonderful. But of course, if you live further north, things are retreating. And also, so many of our birds are going to struggle with climate change, some of the commonest birds we have. And they will, as has happened with the house sparrow, and the hedgehog and the brown hare and lots of very common species we used to take for granted, they've really plummeted, and that is going to start to happen soon if we don't do something about climate change.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the book.
Yeah, it is literally the equinox to the solstice.
Yes, so from March to June.
Yeah.
And why did you stop in June? Was
it felt like the right time. It felt like the subtitle is A Somerset Spring. And we were coming out of lockdown, funnily enough. The first lockdown ended around the 21st of June. The children were about to go back to school. We were allowed to travel. You know, obviously during lockdown, we were allowed to travel a little bit further. So I would cycle off and I would go down to the coast occasionally. But that was the moment where things looked like they were getting back to normal. Clearly, we know with hindsight that it didn't. It was temporary. But it felt like a good point to stop. Also, the irony is this particular habitat is very good in spring because all the migrants arrive, the warblers, the swallows, etc. Then during the summer and autumn, it's pretty quiet, and then it picks up again in the winter months when you get flocks of gulls and things on here, and teal on the reens and things. So it's nice in the winter and it's very good in the spring. Really, as I say in the book, I walk round with Rosie and my family on the summer solstice, and it's more or less stopped. It sort of felt like it was the right time to finish.
And each little chapter has a kind of a theme. There's, you know, there's maybe a particular bird or something particular that you've noticed or has happened at the time.
That's right, week, yes, yeah. And little drawings to show them. And they're mostly birds because, as we know, birds are the most visible wildlife anyway, but particularly here on this very flat, open land with just a few trees and the reens and the, you know, a few bits of reed beds and things. But, you know, there's the odd butterfly. I think I've got the cockchafer beetle at one point, you know. But each chapter has a different theme, and some have more reflection than others, you know. But because I said it was just a diary, I wrote it as it happened. I felt I wanted to document the oddest time in any of our lives, except for people who lived through the Second World War, and there's far fewer of those now. Hopefully we will never have to go through anything like that again, but it was certainly very unusual, and even the more recent lockdowns simply didn't feel the same to me. It felt like a very unusual time, a time to take stock and to think about what matters in life. Actually,
unusually brilliant weather, wasn't it? I mean, you know, it's extraordinary. Yeah.
There's a point in, I think, week 7 where I say this strange stuff started falling from the sky called rain. Yeah, and it was very weird. And we've had this, you know, we'd had the wettest February ever.
Yes.
And one of the coldest Marches ever. And then literally, it was the day after my wife's birthday when lockdown started, the sun came out and that was it. And we were eating out in the garden, you know, we were wandering around in shorts and summer shirts. Whereas this year, I'm wrapped up against the wind at the moment.
It's so easy, isn't it, to actually forget. And it's great to have a diary that documents it. And, you know, so because you can so easily forget when the rain starts pouring and the wind starts howling and, you know, in the middle of May, like we've had this year.
It's been a very odd year. But again, this is part of, I mean, even the sun last year, it's not good because it's part of the whole way that climate change disrupts weather patterns and creates these anomalies and these strange...
Yeah.
And I know Britain's weather, of course, is very, very varied. You mentioned wild hares and hummingbirds earlier. Yeah. That was 2010.
Yeah.
That year, it snowed at the beginning. There was a dampish spring, a few April showers, then a reasonable summer, nothing out of the ordinary, but not terrible, but, you know, three fine days and a thunderstorm, as someone once said. And then a decent, if dry, autumn, and then we had snow again. That will never happen again. That was the last, what I would call, year of normality, the year that was like my childhood. But we've barely had snow since, have we? And that's 10 years now. So those, you know, my children were very young then, and they used to think in the first 3 or 4 years of their life that it snowed every winter, because it did for that very short period. You know, I am an optimist. I hope for the future, and I hope we do sort out the climate emergency issue. And the habitat loss and biodiversity loss issue. But I'm concerned that nature is struggling. And, you know, and even this year, there seem to be fewer migrants than there were last year, for example. The politicians seem unable to understand that it could be a really positive thing, fighting it, because we could have new technology that is cleaner, so we'd have less pollution, people living in cities suffering from terrible air pollution, that would go with electric cars. Renewable energy is already doing a fantastic job at creating clean energy, and again, you know, so all the other things that go with burning fossil fuels.
And I wouldn't hear the motorway from my house.
And you wouldn't hear the motorway from your house, yeah. And, you know, even from a personal experience, a year ago, just before lockdown, I had a very old car, 15-year-old car, and I wanted to get a new one. I looked at electric cars, and they didn't work for me, because I would have had to have driven to my work near Bath, and it would have been 60 miles each way, and I was in danger of running out of battery or having to charge. That's not acceptable. 5 months ago, I bought an electric car that does double the amount that the cars did a year and a half ago. So I can now go 250 miles. So that's fine. And in 2 or 3 years' time, everyone will be driving electric cars because they work. Yep. And that's what we need to do. But we can't just rely on technology.
No. Absolutely. It's been great talking to you, Stephen, and a privilege to see your loop that you walked every day
on a very windy day with almost no birds here at all.
I really enjoyed your book. A lovely read, beautifully written in my opinion.
That means a lot.
That course you're teaching must, as they say, a teacher, when you teach people you actually improve yourself very often.
Absolutely. Teaching nature writing has improved my writing hugely.
Which Stephen does at Bath Smart University.
And guess what? I can hear a skylark. So there we are, skylarks without Rosie.
Yes. Brilliant.
Thank you very much, Lionel. That's great.